Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
David Ivey's father moved the family to Chico to work on the Titan missile. C. David Ivey was the first class to spend all its high school years at Pleasant Valley. Then he began his college studies at Chico State. He has degrees in mechanical, environmental, and civil engineering from Chico State and Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He has professional experience in aircraft carrier defense systems and high-end shopping malls. David Ivey married his high school sweetheart when he got home from a mission to South Africa for the Church of Christ of Latter-day Saints. A year after his first wife died, he remarried and is now a grandfather of 14. He began writing in his spare time and has now published sci-fi stories under the title Beyond the Walls of Darkness. Included in this book are blog posts he has written. David Ivey, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Now, the first part, your stories, you'd call them science fiction.
Of course they are.
But then you have blogs in the second part of your book. And would you call that science fiction? Some people might call it fantasy.
No, I call it logic, really.
Would you call it science fiction?
Well, the type of science fiction that I enjoy, as I mentioned to you last, was the kind that proposes something that is maybe possible, maybe real, and investigates, you know, what would be the ramifications if that really happened, or if that you could do that. And this book is intended to be that kind of science fiction, but most people wouldn't recognize it. So I had to give them some background, and that's what the blogs are, so that they recognize that the things that I'm proposing are really possible.
So this is how you came up with the idea to put these two parts of your book together, one that is definitely science fiction, the first part, and the second part that...
Well, I actually intend the blogs to go on my website as an advertisement and enticement to read the stories.
That's the word that came to my mind, enticement. Well, the first blog in your book is entitled 1, 2, 3, Many Stars. And people, one, two, three, many stars? Well, so
it's taken from an old Eskimo way of counting. You know, to them, they're counting the caribou, and it's 1, 2, 3, and many.
Why bother with any number
if
past?
Beyond past three, that, it's just many.
Well, in the first sentence in this 1, 2, 3, many stars, you tell us there are about 100 billion stars in an average galaxy and 2 trillion galaxies in the universe. And my mind is boggled from the very first sentence in your blog.
So I had read someone else's attempt to help people visualize that. And so I amplified that in the blog. The idea is if you take a teaspoon of salt and spread it out on the table and put it into little piles of 100, you'd end up with, I think it was 5,000 grains of salt in one teaspoon. Okay? So you could say that, you know, as you spread them out, they look like stars. Okay? So you'd have 5,000 stars in a teaspoon. But it would take a liter bottle to hold 1 million stars. It would take 3 bathtubs to hold 1 billion stars. So if you're talking about an average, our galaxy is like 300 billion stars, but the average galaxy, call it 100 billion, that'd be 300 bathtubs of salt. And that's just one galaxy.
So this reminds me of something. It isn't in your book, but I think it's related. The Drake equation.
A fellow proposed an idea, a way of quantifying or trying to get a handle on the probability that there's, well, that we're not alone in the universe. He took, you know, the number of stars in the Milky Way times the number of stars that might have planets, the number of those planets that might have life, the number of planets that have life that might have intelligent life, and so forth, multiplied it out. He came up with about a large range, somewhere between 10 and 10,000 possible intelligent lives, civilizations in our galaxy at this time.
But, Dave, we think we're the only ones. We are the advanced civilization, and we're the superior ones. Yes?
Well, we're listening on radio. You know, okay, we've been using radio for 100 years, and give me a break. There's something beyond radio, and probably something way beyond radio, and they haven't been using radio for a very long time.
So, these other civilizations,
yeah, so,
these other galaxies.
You know, I'm listening to a book right now about owls, and these guys are trying to track owls. They have trackers on them, and they're looking up in this tree, and the tracker says that owl is in that tree, and they cannot see that owl because the owl's just sitting there. I think that's exactly the same thing with those civilizations out there. There's so many of them, but we're listening the wrong way.
Well, then I want to ask you about something else, the Fermi paradox.
Okay. So Fermi was a very famous scientist. He invented the nuclear reactor, and he was about the same time as Drake and looked at the Drake equation and was talking to his other fellow scientists, and he said, well, you know, this all makes sense, but where is everybody? And that's what really started the SETI program, where they're searching for extraterrestrial life, but they're, like I said, I think they're listening to the wrong thing or for the wrong thing. You know, they're listening for radio signals that aren't being used.
My guest is retired engineer C. David Ivey. And in his book, volume one of a series, Beyond Walls of Darkness, and the second part of his book are his blogs. And this is what I'm asking you about, because the first part of his book are science fiction stories. The second part of his book, the blog posts, I'm not convinced they're all fiction.
Well, they're not supposed to be fiction.
Well, you've tried to get across this idea of how immense space and time are. What else can you say to help us understand that?
Well, you mentioned time.
Yes.
For instance, suppose you made a timeline. You know, you do that in school. Let's make each year an eighth of an inch. You know, you can see that, but just barely. That would mean a standard presidential
term
of office would be about a half inch. Okay, so you'd have two presidents to the inch. That's the title of the block. In that case, I'd have to look back to double check the figures, but I think the first Christmas would be about 30 inches. Okay? In 20 feet, you've gotten back to first recorded history. Okay? If you talk about the life of the Earth, you're going to go three-quarters of the way around the circumference of the Earth. If you're talking about the life of the universe, you'd go all the way around the Earth. That's an eighth of an inch increment. You go all the way around the Earth, okay?
That's so hard for – I just – sometimes my mind just can't conceive of these – figures in such quantity.
Right, and that's the history of one planet. Okay, now suppose each one of those stars that we were talking about had just one planet. And we know that some don't have any, but some have a lot more than one. If each one of those had just one planet and you had one timeline for each one, an eighth of an inch wide, that would span as long as the circumference of the Earth, and it would be as wide as the entire galaxy.
Now, we just don't have proof of these things you're talking about, Dave.
We have proof of those things. Those things, all we've talked about so far is the immense number of stars out there and the immense amount of time. Those things we have pretty good proof on, okay? Now you come down to, is it even conceivable that in all of that time, in all of that space, we're the only intelligent life?
But we don't have evidence. We don't have evidence, Dave.
But like I said, there's very good reason for that. If they are out there at all, and if they have been doing this for any length of time, we have been around for thousands, and if you talk to the anthropologists, millions of years. And out of all of that time that we've been doing this, the amount of time that we've been putting something out into space that somebody else could recognize is minuscule. If they have been doing it even longer than we have, then they've progressed further, and they're not using the same tools that we're talking about. So the chances of us recognizing them from this distance, it's not as minuscule as we once thought it was, because our science is getting to the point now that we can actually see planets in other solar systems and check their spectra. And we're looking for the kind of gases that life produces. So we're getting to the point where we can maybe actually have proof, but it's still a long ways off.
Well, medicine is progressing such that in my parents' lifetime, the lifespan was much shorter during my parents' lifetime.
Oh, certainly.
And now we live a lot longer. And if medicine continues to progress, how much longer can we live?
There's a term, and I cannot remember it. I call it a senior moment. But there's a term in science fiction for that phenomenon. The concept being in many, many science fiction stories that the longer you live, the more medicine progresses and finds ways to fix you. And so then you live longer and they learn more, and you live longer and you learn and they learn more. And eventually it gets to the point where you just don't die.
I wish that were true of dogs. I would love for my dog to not die. But
I mean, there are animals on the earth today that we don't know if they live forever, but we can't prove that they die. There are several that we found that they ought to die. We have a standard in science that says the bigger the animal, the longer they live, and smaller the animal, the shorter they live. And they have one called a hydra that they've studied for years. I mean years. And it should live a few months, and they can't find them dying of natural causes. So the idea of living forever is not scientifically infeasible.
So if I keep living, I even find myself now prioritizing, okay, what should I do? What are my priorities?
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. Okay, I think what you might be alluding to is the concept that if you have a civilization now where a lot of the people, maybe all of the people, live forever, and they have the opportunity to learn I mean, literally everything, given enough time. Obviously, How to Live Forever is going to be the top of the list because there's so much to do. But after that, they're going to have to realize that having a stable environment, a stable government, something that they can trust, that one that isn't like the Star Wars dictator that then is going to have the rebellion come in and overthrow him. You know, you don't want that kind of instability. You want something that's going to last. And frankly, I believe that sooner or later, I mean, this has been going on for so long, over so much space, there's going to have been so many intelligent civilizations out there come and go that somebody's going to figure out the idea that if they actually work together, cooperate instead of compete, that, you know, maybe they can hang on there longer and work together and things don't have to fall apart. It'll be more stable.
So we learn from each other if we cooperate.
Okay. Makes a little bit of sense.
My guest is Chico author David Ivey, and he has written a collection of science fiction stories, but also in this book are his blogs. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, David Ivey, and he's a Chico author who writes science fiction stories and also blogs about science questions. And in his book, Beyond the Walls of Darkness, it's a series, he includes blogs that he has posted. And some of these blogs raise the questions like, well, what if... Dave, what if what you're saying comes to pass? What if?
Exactly. That's the question. That's what I'm proposing in the book. What if there's a civilization out there that actually did learn how to live forever, basically learns all things, learns how to cooperate with one another and with those around them so that they're not falling apart right away? The second highest priority that they're going to have is who to entrust with this kind of knowledge. Who controls? We know how to completely obliterate an entire city at once. And we have, obviously, in our movies, we can imagine obliterating an entire world. There's the possibility science realizes that you can actually create worlds by using forces that are beyond our hopes of control, but they could possibly control, that you could actually create worlds and solar systems. Who do you allow to control that?
Well, then if everybody's going to live forever, then self-centered people will live forever.
Well, exactly. The problem is the people who want to control that are not the ones that you want to have doing it.
Yes.
Okay? The ones that want control, the ones that want to be in charge, that are only happy when everyone is answering to them, those are the ones that you want to figure out who they are, and you want to sort those guys out. The ones that are like George Washington, that after the Revolution, they offered him to be king of the U.S., and he turned it down. Those are the guys that you want to have in charge, not the ones that would like to, but the ones that would do it because, you know, somebody has to do it. They're doing it for the good of others.
Well, I think you mentioned the word stability, did you not?
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we go about ensuring that?
Imagine for a second one of these real-time game shows on TV, you know, where they put them on the island and they give them challenges and so forth. Imagine that you took an island and you just loaded it with hidden cameras and microphones and this type of thing. And then you put all of the presidential candidates on there, on that island. Do you think you could come up with some challenges that would help you find out who the real leaders are and who the wannabes are and who the petty tyrants are? I believe that they use the same concept. Like I said, they have learned everything. One of the keys
questions. If we live long enough, we get around to learning everything.
Well, one of the key concepts is, what is life? What are you? Who are you? One of my a favorite science fiction story that I read years ago, so I cannot remember the name of it. I wish I could give the author credit. But he proposed people that lived forever. They were immortal but not indestructible, which means, you know, they do something stupid and they could lose their body. But the essence of them was kept in an indestructible kernel. We'd call it a mini computer in their head, and it's encapsulated in an indestructible capsule. And as long as that capsule was still available, it can be implanted in another body, and then they're back and go on with their escapades and so forth. That's nonsense and not something that can ever happen in reality. But the question is, what is that essence of us? What makes us what we are? We can grow organs in a lab, and they sit there. They're just lumps. If we ever got to the point where we could grow an entire body, all the neural systems and everything, I believe it would just sit there. There is something that is the essence of our personality.
Well, we are the experiences we have, but we're also what we are born with our parents, the old nature versus nurture. And
well, I tell a story in my blogs. Is it all right if I share it here?
I think I know the story you're going to tell.
Yeah. My wife would kick me.
She would kick you? Speaking of kicking.
Well, it's a little personal, but when she was pregnant with our firstborn, the doctor told her to always lay on her side, not on her back, and she was good for a long time. And finally, after months and months of this, you know, it's like 8 months now, she couldn't stand it anymore. She rolled over on her back, and her eyes got big, and she grabbed one of my hands and put it on one side and one hand and put it on the other. And I could feel distinctly enough, I could tell which one was a little pair of hands and which was a little pair of heels, just pressing out and expressing his dissatisfaction with the management. And she rolled over on her side again, and he was fine. And that is my first son, who is a very good fellow, but very stubborn. So second son came along, second child came along. Same thing, laid on her side, eventually couldn't stand it anymore, rolled over, and I could see what was going on. She was having a tummy quake. He was throwing a temper tantrum, very obviously. And so sure enough, that's my second son. Everything's very big, very flamboyant.
So before they were even born, their personalities were becoming evident to you.
The third son, I told her, please, when you get ready to roll over, wake me up if you have to. And she did, and I put my hands on one side and the other. She rolled over, and I could feel him just move into a different position and stop.
Adapt.
Because that's his personality. So, yes, same nature, same nurture. Basic personality was there from the get-go and has always been true.
My guest is retired engineer David Ivy, and he is a Chico author now. He's begun writing in his retirement. And in his book, Beyond the Walls of Darkness, Volume 1, is a series of blogs that he has written. And he raises all kinds of questions, like if we live forever, can we live forever if medicine keeps improving, or if I'm going to use that word. And then does immortality mean we have the same capabilities if we live forever? And apparently, if we just keep living long enough, we'll gain all knowledge. We'll have all the knowledge possible. But then who controls it? So how do you control? How do you govern without people wanting to rebel?
Let's get back to that one. We were talking about the basic essence of you. If you could know the basic essence, then you could know who to put in charge. If you could sort out the ones that are pretending to be George Washington's and they're actually Adolf Hitler's, okay? Now, this is the, remember I said I like the stories where you propose what if, and then you look at what does that mean? If that's possible or if that's true, well, then what does it mean? Well, this is the essence, okay, this point right here. And I draw my concepts obviously from science, but also from science fiction and also from the scriptures. And in a lot of places, there is a fundamental belief that there is an essence to us. And I don't mean belief, but I mean the kind of evidence that science can't put a finger on it, can't take a picture of it, so they don't accept it. But frankly, a lot of people, there's been a lot of evidence in the past that there's something that people have called, labeled ghosts, spirits, chi, whatever name you want to put on it, that there is something that is in essence that continues and is separate from the body. All right, here's the proposal. Suppose that's real, that there really is that essence. I call it spirit just because it's easiest. If that's true, then this advanced race who learns and figures out the essence of life along with everything else and wants to be able to sort out the Hitlers from the George Washingtons, they could take those essences, those spirits, and put them in temporary bodies, bodies that don't live forever. So no matter what these guys do, they're just going to be around for a little while. But it would be like putting them on that island with all the video cameras and the recorders and watching to see, you know, who screws up and who takes charge and who's a petty tyrant and who's really trying to help everybody else. It helps sort them out. I believe that's what they are doing. I don't mean that they could do it. I don't mean it's possible. I mean we are it. That is us. We are members of that race. And we are here being tested, being observed.
Well, you use the word probation in your book. And probation, what do you mean by that, Dave?
After this temporary trial, you might be sorted out, kicked out, Hitler, Stalin, but you might be put in charge. Those that are put in charge, there's indication, again, from lots of outside evidence that they might have powers to be able to pop into somebody's bedroom to deliver a message. That's not a power that you want to give to anybody. They could read your mind, know what you're thinking. Again, not something that you want everyone to have the ability to do.
In fact, I think you say you've tried to read your wife's mind and you haven't been too successful
at it. No, I'm not very good at that. She is quite good at it, though. So the idea is for probation is it's not just heaven or hell, in or out, but how trustworthy are you? How much power and abilities not only can you be trusted with, but what are you going to need? What are you going to want to do? What are you going to be good at in the eternities? Are you going to want, like me, to be an environmental engineer?
Yes, that was one of your degrees, yeah, environmental engineering.
It's also one of my stories. I wrote a story about, okay, if I was in eternity, what would I do?
Well, since you mentioned the word heaven, you include some written by Mark Twain. And I don't think many people are familiar with this. We love quotes by Mark Twain. And this in your book is an extract in your book. And he says, Captain Stormfield's visit to heaven.
Right.
And so what does Mark Twain have to say about this guy visiting heaven?
Well, you know, Mark Twain lived in the time and the era when it was in or out, heaven or hell, you know, and heaven was clouds and harps and halos. And so he wrote a story about Captain Stormfield who went to heaven and he was given his harp and his halo, and he found his clouds. And where was that?
You say the following extract contains another science sci-fi author's tongue-in-cheek ideas of forever.
Right.
And so you refer to Mark Twain as another sci-fi author.
Oh, he is a science fiction author. If you read his story about the floating city. But anyway, so he's talking about this old gentleman next to me says, don't you know any tune but the one you've been picking at all day? And he says, not another blessed one, says I. Are you glad to be here? Says I, old man, I'll be frank with you. This ain't as near my idea of bliss as I thought it was going to be when I used to go to church. Says he, what do you say to knocking off or calling it a half a day? That's me, says I. I never wanted to get off watch so bad in all my life.
This is my guest, David Ivey, reading from his book, Beyond the Walls of Darkness. And he actually was reading a few words from something that Mark Twain wrote back in the day when it was one or the other, heaven or hell, and what it was like to be there. So what would you like us to get from the information in your blogs, Dave?
The concept that it is completely possible, scientifically possible, that there is a civilization out there that literally lives forever, knows all things, and that we might even be a part of that, preparing to become citizens in that civilization. If we show that we can learn the basic essence that made it possible, which is cooperation instead of competition.
Cooperation, yeah.
If we can learn that one principle and demonstrate in our life that, yeah, we can do that, then literally the sky's the limit.
Well, I think people will be intrigued by the questions you raise for them to contemplate. I'll remind listeners that my guest has been C. David Ivey. He's a retired engineer and has taken up writing in his retirement. And in this book, Beyond the Walls of Darkness, is a series of blogs. So thank you, David.
Thank you.
After a break, I'll be talking to author Kimberly McIntosh about her book, How Lizzie Chose Her Mama. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest, retired Reading massage therapist Kimberly McIntosh, has now written a children's book. She is the mother of 6 children and 14 grandchildren. Her book, How Lizzie Chose Her Mama, is a story about love, faith, and sacrifice to help adopted children feel less alienated and more a part of their adopted family. The characters in her book are based on Kimberly McIntosh and her daughters. Kimberly McIntosh, welcome.
Hello.
You know, I read an article about a dad who adopted children, and he had fostered children, and he really never expected to become a father of an adopted child. But he got this phone call, and the social worker said, I'm going to bring this young man over, this 11-year-old. And so after she left, this young 11-year-old, he said, looked at me and says, I was told that since I'm 11, I can choose who my father should be. So I'm choosing you. Is that anything like your experience?
Well, no, basically what it was is when I was a little girl, my grandmother adopted me from my mom. And I felt really sad and I pined for my mom because I was, you know, I was 4 years old. And so when I had 4 beautiful, wonderful boys that I gave birth to, I really wanted a daughter because I've always wanted a daughter. I made a decision at 4 that I wanted to adopt or have a daughter to do all the things with me my mom never did with me. And so that was kind of my lifelong dream. I had 4 beautiful boys, and I knew I kept having boys. So I decided I want to adopt. And I thought it was a good idea anyway, because there's children out there that need parents. So when my older 2 boys, when they both turned 18 different times, they left, and I had 2 little boys left at home, Duncan and Owen, and they were 10 and 12. So my husband finally realized I wasn't going to ever give up about adopting, so he finally gave in. So we went to a place called Adoption Horizon, and we found 2 little girls that were sisters, and we got them on August the 27th, and Bernice turned 5 September the 24th. And I remembered it because it was my birthday.
Oh, sweet.
And so anyway, so what ended up happening was when they came home, The girls were in the bedroom playing, but when I went in to check on them, Bernice was looking out the window, and I knew in my heart what she felt. She had tears rolling down her face, and I knew she was pining over her mother, or her natural mother, because she remembered her. Even though her mother had left her at 2 and a half, she still remembered her. So anyway, so I prayed about it, and I got this story. And I set her down on my lap, and I told her the story. It was just her at the time, because Lizzie was 2 and a half. So she went, okay, and she actually literally accepted me. When she turned 18, I said, I have your mother's natural name. Do you want it? And she goes, Mom, I chose you. I don't want her. So it really made her feel better. So about a couple of days later, I went to Stuart Merrill Springs to a seminar, and I had lunch with some lady I never knew because I went by myself. So what ended up happening, we had lunch, and I go, oh, you want to hear something cool? And I told her that I had written this story and told it to my daughter, and she starts crying. And I go, what's wrong? And she goes, I gave a baby away, and I hate myself at 16, and you just healed me. Now I know I'm part of the plan of my baby. Yeah. And she said, what happened? She goes, you need to put this in the world so you can help women that give their babies away and children so they feel like they had a choice. So that's how I made the book.
My guest is Kimberly McIntosh. She lives in Reading and is describing how she became an adoptive mother. And this man who unexpected, he didn't expect to be an adopted father, but he said when he was growing up, he felt like he never truly belonged. And he said that later that being an adoptive father has changed, he said it changed my life and inspired him to be vocal about adoption. And that's what you're doing. You're writing this book. And he also says it's one of those things that was always meant to be. And that sounds
absolutely
like what you were just saying. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Always meant to be. Oh, your story it touches my heart, Kimberly.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you have an illustrator from your book. I didn't give the name of your illustrator, but who illustrated your book?
His name is Jeffrey Crank. He is a sign painter, and he has a business in Reading. And I met him, and because I still do massage once in a while. And so I met him doing massage, and I told him about my book. I said, would you be interested? And he said he had written some other, he had done some artwork for other books. He read my story because it wasn't a book form at that time. He says, oh my gosh, Kimberly, we got to get this out here to help people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I told him today that I was going to be online, and he goes, I don't even care if I never make money. Mm-hmm. I hope this gets out there for kids and people that have given babies away, because it's heartbreaking for both.
Yeah.
I hated that I was adopted, but my grandmother was good to me, but she wasn't my mom, and I never got that out of my heart.
Yeah. Well, why don't you read a little bit for first on the cover? Would you describe what Jeffrey put on the cover of your book? Again, the title of the book is How Lizzie Chose Her Mama.
The cover is the best one picture. It shows Lizzie sitting on a swing, and she's pouting, and she's looking like far away. And there's rabbits and pigeons on the swing set, and the rabbits under on the ground. It's a beautiful illustration.
Yeah, and he did a good job of making her look like she's pouting. And why would she be pouting, Kimberly?
Well, the reason why is because I'll read a little bit of this.
Okay.
There once was a little girl named Lizzie who felt lonely and left out. Her big sister Bernice had gone to a birthday party and Lizzie had not been invited. Lizzie had to stay home alone, and this was the first time she'd ever been without her sister. Lizzie tried to swing on her swing in the swing set in the backyard, but it didn't make her feel better. She was used to Bernice pushing her. Without Bernice, Lizzie didn't go very high or fast. It wasn't fun for Lizzie to swing by herself.
Now, that lovely picture you described is on the cover, and it's also reproduced opposite what you just read in your book. And I was wondering if that lovely background is actually somewhere in Reading?
No. We lived in Burt Ranch. It's between Weaverville and Willow Creek. So I told him I wanted pine trees in it.
Well, they're lovely green trees.
Yes.
You want to read a little more in your book?
Feeling grumpy and lonely, Lizzie ran into the house and straight to the kitchen where her mom was working on some artwork. She put her head on her mom's lap, seeking love and comfort. It felt better being with her mama. Lizzie looked up and asked, "Mama, can you please tell me the story how I came to have you as my mommy?" Lizzie's mom's eyes lit up. She decided to tease Lizzie just a little. "Oh, Lizzie, you want to hear that story again?" she said. "I have told you that story at least 200 times. But, Mommy, I love that story. It's my very favorite one ever," Lizzie replied. "Please tell me the story. Pretty please, with sugar on top," Lizzie pleaded.
Let me ask you a question, Kimberly. In this book, your illustrator, Jeffrey Crank, has a picture of this mother, and the little girl's head is lying in the mother's lap. And the mother is in the middle of painting. And do you paint in addition to being a massage therapist?
Yeah, I'm an artist, but I just never could do this kind. I tried to do the artwork for this book for 30 years, and I just couldn't do it. And I found Jeff, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, well, they are lovely. And the mother Lizzie has black hair in the illustrations, and the mother has red hair.
And I have red hair, and Lizzie has black hair.
Because these characters in your book are based on you and your daughters. So
yes,
we feel like we're reading your story.
If you look at the picture in the back of the book of me and the girls.
Yes, on the back.
I gave Jeff pictures of my daughters, and they look like these pictures. He tried to make them cartoonish like the faces of my daughters.
Yeah, there's a beautiful color picture of you under About the Author. And underneath it says, Kimberly McIntosh is a dedicated mother and author. She lives in Redding, California. And there's the picture with you and Bernice and Lizzie. And again, that same photograph on the very back of your book.
Yeah.
And you describe how Lizzie chose her mother is a story of how a little spirit, Lizzie, chose her birth mother so she could be adopted by a mother of her choosing. It's a story about love, faith, and sacrifice, and helps adopted children feel less alienated and more part of their adopted family. And so
right.
She actually chose you to be her mother.
Yes.
And that must make you feel pretty good, I would think, to understate it.
Yeah. Well, I believe we choose our parents, but that's just mm-hmm. what I believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't too far-fetched for me to make this story up.
Well, you have that. Well, Jeff illustrates this redheaded mother with this little girl with black hair and little hearts circling around their heads. And why don't you read one more page?
Okay.
Shows a picture of the mother with her finger on her chin.
Yeah. It says, Mom put her finger on her chin and tapped it, pretending to think about Lizzie's request. Mom knew she loved telling Lizzie the story as much as Lizzie loved to hear it. This little game they played was part of the fun. The more Mom hesitated, the more Lizzie jumped up and down and begged her to tell her.
Well, you know, that is realistic. Children love you to read the same book to them over and over. So I'm sure I can just imagine how Lizzie wanted to hear that story over and over. And it's such a sweet story. Do you have anything else you'd like to add to our conversation, Kimberly?
Yeah. Well, I hope that people that hear this, that have adopted children, I hope they decide to get it because it really takes the edge off of it. To feel like you're left behind or not worthy, that's a really hard place to come from for the rest of your life. And I wanted both of my daughters to be proud of who I was and who they were and not feel like they were less than because their natural mother couldn't handle being their mother anymore.
Well, you mentioned you wrote for your children, and I might add that you have mentioned you have sons, and the dedication, you say, dedicated to my children, Bernice, Lizzie, Tom, Brandon, Duncan, and Owen, and the women who give the gift of life, their baby, to another. Thank you so much, Kimberly, for writing this book.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. It really did help my children.
I'm sure it did. Again, my guest has been Reading author Kimberly McIntosh. The title of her children's book is How Lizzie Chose Her Mama. Thank you, Kimberly.
All right. Have a nice day.
I would also like to thank my first guest, David Ivey, whose book is Beyond the Walls of Darkness, and that book includes blog posts. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Mother, this morning, after the humbling sweep of imperfections and the ritual banishing of morning breath, I caught my mother's eyes in the smudged mirror before me. She's been showing up in my reflection more these days, in the way my body holds its story with a little more fortitude and forgiveness, the way we both can cry when a hug does its job, the way we both feel like time is slipping through our fingers, the sunspots that have found a home happily on my skin, the way she wishes she didn't have so many. There was a time I feared that our likeness would be the undoing of me, the way I tried to untether every knot that tied me to her. But now I stand here, vulnerably close to 30, I find myself praying for more sameness than difference, that I might first carry her softness, that I might wave at strangers, that I might lead with love, hope without reason, give without needing return, that in finding my way back to her, I find my way toward myself. Kelly Lieberman.
You can't keep a good town down. You can't keep a good town down, even when it's burnt to the ground. We're all coming back to take our town paradise back. We've been through it all. We're still standing tall. The fire will never win, even in the wind. The people say, you can't keep a good town down. By Judith Soto.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.